You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 357 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk The Penguin number 3, Unstoppable Doom Patrol number 7, Steelworks number 5, Green Arrow number 5, Batman Catwoman, The Gotham War Red Hood number 2, Alan Scott, The Green Lantern number 1, Amazon's Attack number 1, Action Comics 1058, Detective Comics 1075, The Flash number 2, Wonder Woman number 2, and Doom Patrol season 4 episode 11, Portal Patrol. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. DC announces a 3-issue Black Label series titled The Batman First Night from Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins. The year is 1939. A series of violent murders has begun in Gotham, and the recent emergence of the mysterious vigilante known as the Batman has the power brokers of the city living in fear of institutional collapse. All of the evidence in the murder investigation defies logic. The perpetrators are all men who died in the electric chair. The Batman First Night number 1 will be released March 5th, 2024.
Drew, I'm very intrigued by the premise, and I've really liked a lot of the Black Label stuff that they're doing. I am surprised at Dan Jurgens being the writer. Not because I don't think he can do it, to be clear. I don't know that I've ever read something by him, Drew, that I was like, oh, I wonder what this would look like if you weren't writing for, you weren't writing family friendly. So I'm actually kind of intrigued to see if that changes his style at all.
Yeah, that will be interesting to see. I'm trying to think of a time where I read something that wasn't family friendly of his, and I can't think of a time.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very like hot and cold on him because obviously he made Booster Gold, so. Yeah, you know, that's awesome. I haven't loved a lot of his more recent stuff. I just kind of feel like his writing is a little outdated. That's not to say that he hasn't made great stories, but I'm kind of intrigued. I really like the premise for the story, and I kind of just am intrigued to see what a Dan Jurgens Black Label book looks like.
Well, I'm planning on having it, planning on reviewing it on the podcast, so you'll get your chance.
Oh boy. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I can't think. I'm trying to think of somebody else I could compare to that I would also be surprised. Maybe like Stan Lee, maybe. I mean, obviously, I know that's not possible at this point. But like, you know what I mean? Like, imagine Stan Lee writing an Image comic. It would be weird. Yeah, I don't know. I'm very intrigued to see what it's like.
All right. Up next for DC News. As part of Chip Zdarsky's ongoing run on Batman, the true origins of the Clown Prince of Crime are about to be uncovered with a 3-part storyline, The Joker Year One, launching this February, running through Batman number 142 to 144. With all 3 issues released the same month, the storyline will flash back to the accident that transformed the leader of the Red Hood gang into the Joker, that audiences know and love today. With all the new details that DC teases will have readers questioning everything they know about the Joker. The story doesn't just take place in the past, however, with both the return of a mysterious figure from Batman's past, as well as the reformation of the Red Hood gang, complicating matters for both the Dark Knight and the Joker alike. When the Joker is the only person who can stop the Red Hood gang causing trouble, and the Batman's past is bringing new threats into Gotham City, maybe it's time to ask yourself, who really is the good guy in this story, and who is the villain?
Yeah, I often am confused at whether the Joker's a villain or not. That makes sense. I'm not shocked that they're doing this, Drew. I mean, it's honestly shocking it's taken DC this long to inevitably do this story. I guess maybe we just got lucky that writers kind of knew better, but I guess it couldn't last forever. So, hey, here we go. The character that nobody really needs the backstory for, we're going to get a full explanation for. Woo! Let's go.
I've read stories that revisited the Red Hood stuff before, so we'll see what they do.
I just don't want it. It's just not necessary. I don't know, man. I know that we've DC, I feel like, has been playing a lot more strongly recently with exploring the origins of the Joker more. I don't feel like a lot of people were asking for it, Drew. In fact, I feel like if you asked people, they would be more likely to be like, you know, I don't know that I actually need that. It's kind of what makes the character who he is.
I agree with you. I don't really care about the Joker's origin either.
And I certainly don't need to question whether Bruce or the Joker is the hero in the story. I think that's been pretty thoroughly resolved.
Well, when I read that, the thing I was thinking was, we know Batman's been going through the Zur-En-Arr.
Oh, yeah.
He's been having issues with his Zur-En-Arr persona, and I have a feeling we're going to see that happening in this story.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I'm not disagreeing with you. My problem is that's still not a great explanation because, I mean, do we really need to go through the Joker's body count here?
Nope, we don't. All right, and moving on to our last bit of DC news. James Gunn has cast Nicholas Holt as Lex Luthor and also Maria Gabriela de Faria for Superman Legacy, confirming members of the Authority will be appearing in the film.
I'm pretty excited by the Lex casting, Drew. They're definitely going younger with the cast overall, which makes sense because, you know, it doesn't take that long for the cast to get too old for certain roles. Obviously, Lex is not necessarily a young character, but in a world where this goes right, and this actually sets up a universe and it does well and it springboard into something that we hope takes off, you want actors that can play the characters for a while. And Nicholas Holt, I enjoy as an actor. I liked him a lot in the X-Men, the more recent X-Men movies. I like it a lot, Drew, and he can play that character for a long time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm looking forward to Superman Legacy and James Gunn's new universe, so we're getting closer. I'm glad all the strikes are over and things are starting to move along again.
Agreed.
All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
It's a new era for Doctor Who.
Life depends on change and renewal.
And the crew from Earth Station Who podcast will continue to guide you through the past, present, and future of the franchise.
Though not necessarily in that order.
Join us for some wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey talk of stories new and old.
Listen to Earth Station Who wherever you access your podcasts. We're a proud member of the ESO Network.
We're all stories in the end.
Attention, people of Earth! Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast. It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us. Bring coffee.
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at flopcast.net.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk the Penguin number 3. Penguin tells Agent Espinoza that he requires 5 addresses. Penguin needs new goons as his former goons have shown their disloyalty and will soon be dead. Agent Espinoza disapproves of Penguin's choices because his choices were former patriots. Penguin states that perhaps once, but these people were left shattered. Penguin has gathered the team formerly known as the Force of July. Lady Liberty, she used to fire psychic energy through her Liberty Torch. Penguin found her in a bar and offered her lots of money. Major Victory, former team leader who used to possess superhuman strength, flight, and energy shooting. Penguin found him in the boxing ring and the help put him in his place. The Sparkler, He projected light beams from his fingers like fireworks. He's the only one from the team that got his life together and became a teacher. Penguin threatened to kill his sister. Mayflower once made plants grow, twist and wilt at her whim. Penguin promised her a chance to meet Poison Ivy. The last recruit is Silent Majority, who had the ability to duplicate himself. Penguin found him living under a bridge. Penguin wonders if this is the original or just one of the copies that survived. Penguin has gathered the team in a room with folding chairs. Underneath each seat is a pistol. Penguin orders the team to grab their pistols and shoot the next person who comes through the door. When the door opens, the team stands up, all ready to shoot. To be continued.
Drew, I really liked this issue. It was fun seeing Penguin force the team into working for him. In some cases, in other cases, it just took some money. I had never heard of this team before, though. But it was too weird and specific to be made up. And this team had in fact existed in comics before this. But that was the thing, Drew. Like, as I was reading, I'm like, this is such a bizarre thing. I know that this existed. What an awesome name, The Force of July. Just perfectly, perfectly comic book.
This had to be a Golden Age comic.
You would be wrong.
Silver Age?
Actually, no. The Bronze Age, 1984.
Whoa! I'm surprised.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. Like, Drew, I agree completely with you. The Force of July is such a cheesy name, and the names of the different members, all of that screams old school, and yet not, I mean, it is old, but relatively speaking, not the era I would have expected.
Definitely not. This was a really good comic. I like how we saw Penguin, you know, gathering the team and what lengths he did to get them together. Yeah, I understand him not wanting to go back to his old goons, and, you know, this was a team trained by the military or special forces or whatever. And, once Penguin got them in line, they'll probably be good goons for him.
I would say a little bit more qualified than the normal goon, too.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Unstoppable Doom Patrol number 7. Robot exclaims that General Immortus has become the Candlemaker, but the General corrects him, stating that he is something new, an unending eternal flame. He tries to use his new power, but the transformation is not complete. Kipling states that they still have a chance to stop him. The Chief leads the Doom Patrol in battle against the Brotherhood of Evil. With the help of Negative Man, the quiz is brought to the underground, where Jane convinces her to help them against Immortus. Larry contacts Mento, who uses their telepathic abilities against Immortus, blocking his connection to his new power. Robot Man punches him while the quiz opens up a portal beneath Immortus and he disappears. Mento has wiped the memory of the Brotherhood of Evil and had their teammate Warp teleport them home. As the Doom Patrol celebrate their victory, Peacemaker shows up with an army. Kipling cannot teleport them out of there with his banged up head. Degenerate powers up and attacks them, while the rest of the Doom Patrol escapes. The Doom Patrol will return. Elsewhere, in the space between universes, known as the Bleed, Immortus lands on a street at the feet of a being known as the Batwoman Who Laughs. The end? Question mark?
Much like the Doom Patrol, Drew, I was left a bit unsatisfied by the end. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like we're going to get another Doom Patrol miniseries, which is good. But as an ending to this arc, I could have done with a little bit more. A little inconclusive.
Yeah, I agree with you. They just kind of left it kind of open, didn't they? And
They left it as if it was an ongoing. You know what I mean? Like, the ending is totally fine, Drew, if there's an issue 8, which I understand effectively is probably going to be the case, because it seems like there's going to be another mini that probably is going to pick up right where it left off. But, like, if that's what you're going to do, why not just keep the same mini? Like, there's no rule that says a mini series can only be 6 to 7 issues.
If I remember right, when we first announced this mini series, I thought it was supposed to be a series. And maybe it's always felt like they were writing it as a series as they were doing it. I wonder if they announced it as a series and then decided to change it to a miniseries.
I mean, I'm sure they didn't want to commit to it being an ongoing. And I enjoy it, Drew, but I understand. Like, I get it. But yeah, I mean, like you said, I totally agree. They are absolutely writing this as if it's an ongoing. The issue ends as if we're going to read issue 8 next month. And I don't know that that's the case. Ultimately, if they write the second half of this story, Drew, it's going to be fine. Like, in the long run, you're just going to be able to read both stories and it'll flow perfectly well. But in the short term, though, I don't know when the next time is that we're going to read this story. So that's not a very satisfying way to leave things off for now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought it was weird we're bringing the Batwoman who laughs into this. I mean, she kind of fits with Doom Patrol, but this is a weird character to pull in, I thought.
I also just don't care for that character, so it's an uphill climb for me.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Steelworks number 5. Years earlier, Amertek Industries building. Future location of Walker Industries. Sean Carey is late for work once again. As he is walking by division manager Charles Walker III's office, John Henry Irons is inside quitting his job. His contract allows him to because of a moral clause. Metropolis City Courthouse. Weeks later, Amertek tries to prevent John Henry from taking his inventions, but it was in his contract. Amertek tries to tie him up in court, but it decimates Amertek's stock. With Amertek losing money, Sean Carey is laid off. His wife gets sick, and then he finds out he doesn't have any health insurance. He does have accidental death insurance. In desperation, Sean Carey walks into incoming traffic, but his plans are foiled when his life is saved by Steel. Steelworks Tower now. Nat rushes into John Henry's office, interrupting a kiss between him and Lana. A Steel suit is attacking the city, and the Super Family has responded. Problem is that it is being powered by Genesis energy. Steel, Nat, and Lana all respond. Steel realizes it's Charles Walker III in the suit. Steel tells Superman to organize the family. He will take care of this. And the comic ends with Steel about to swing his hammer at Walker's suit. That ending, it wasn't very... I didn't feel climactic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just like... It felt just cut off to me.
There were some important things that were established in this issue. The backstory showing the guy kind of bankrupting his company going after John Henry Irons, which felt very... I mean, comics are wish fulfillment, right? But that felt extremely like fantasy wish fulfillment, more so than dudes flying around with lasers coming out of their eyes, Drew. You know, I know that sounds ridiculous, but like the idea that a multi-billion-dollar corporation would bankrupt itself going after one individual certainly is going to appeal to a lot of people right now reading the comic. But I had to kind of roll my eyes where I was like, this is the most unbelievable part of this whole thing. Now, again, to be fair, an important part of the story. So like this issue covered worthwhile plot. But at the same time, by the time I got to the end, it felt like they really wanted to get to the next issue. It felt like this one was sort of just here because it had to be. And the one that they really wanted to do was next month.
I agree with you. I mean, this was a lot of backstory setup stuff. So, you know, letting us in on what was going on with all these characters before we move forward. And that's probably why when I got to the end of the story, it just felt like it wasn't done.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Arrow number 5. Oliver and Old Oliver are being chased. Old Oliver drives his car off a cliff, and it transforms into an aeroplane. Old Oliver flies Oliver to the Aero Cave. Roy Harper confronts Jade about their daughter, and the two get into an argument. Black Canary interrupts their argument with a sonic whistle and refocuses them on the task at hand, finding Leanne, Connor, and Ollie. When Oliver talks with Old Oliver and learns that he never came back to the island, Oliver realizes that is a lie. He had been back to the island several times, but he never told anyone. Oliver shoots Old Oliver in the eye and learns he is a robot. Old Oliver states that he is Green Arrow's greatest enemy and then transports him to another place. Oliver comes across a different Oliver with a white feather. This is the Oliver that has returned from the dead. Suddenly, multiple Green Arrows show up. The white feather Green Arrow shoots Oliver and pushes him off a building. To be continued in Dead Again.
Ugh.
I agree with you. That's what I thought when I read this. I'm like, is this over yet?
The most concise I can be is that I, again, to reiterate for the 100th time for our listeners, I really don't like Williamson's writing, and this issue did not change my opinion. That's all I got.
Yeah, I didn't really care for the story that much, and by the time I got done reading it, I'm like, are we done with this miniseries yet? Because I am.
The only thing I felt, Drew, was a sense of dread at trying to figure out who Williamson thinks Oliver's nemesis is. I don't know. I don't really know what my assumption, and I think I feel decent about this assumption, Drew, is that he's going to make up someone new, because that's pretty much his MO. And he's basically unilaterally decided that Oliver has a new nemesis. So, I don't know. I'm quite ready for this to be done.
Yeah, I think we only have one more issue of this miniseries, so.
Thank God.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman, Catwoman, the Gotham War, Red Hood number 2. Gotham City, a week ago. Joker has a message for Red Hood and gives it to some former goons of his that now work for Catwoman. Across town, Red Hood is beating up people in a bar looking for Scarecrow. Red Hood wants revenge against Scarecrow for killing Bash. Catwoman shows up and states that one of the men that Red Hood trained desperately needs to talk to him. Red Hood is waiting in the park for Catwoman's goon to show up with Ravager. Ravager is more interested in having sex in the bushes, but Red Hood declines, stating that they have a mission. Ravager accidentally steps on the guy's corpse. His eyes have been clawed out. Ravager finds Joker's note. Red Hood gives Ravager Joker's list of possible hideouts for Manhunter to scout out. She is not to make a move without Red Hood. Red Hood promises to meet back up with Ravager in 48 hours. 24 hours later, Red Hood agrees to help Catwoman if she helps find Scarecrow. 48 hours later, Ravager waits for Red Hood on the roof of Big Belly Burger, but he does not show up. 49 hours later, Batman confronts Red Hood and takes him back to one of his micro caves. 50 hours later, Batman is injecting a needle in Jason's neck. 51 hours later, Ravager wonders where Jason is. Ravager calls Marquis, who doesn't know where Red Hood is. Joker is also pacing back and forth, playing with a yo-yo, wondering why Red Hood has not shown up. Joker had left very obvious clues. When Joker learns that Batman has Red Hood, Joker decides it's up to him to save him. 52 hours later, Jason is a changed man and scared. Jason rescued a little girl from a burning building and then runs into Scarecrow, who promises to kill Jason. Joker shows up and battles Scarecrow, stabbing him with a knife. A crossbeam falls on Jason, trapping him. Joker hears voices coming and decides that is his clue to leave. To be continued in Batman, Catwoman, the Gotham War, Scorched Earth, and concluded in The Joker, The Man Who Stopped Laughing, number 12. I don't know about you, Cletus, but when I read this, it felt like a convoluted mess.
I would agree. I would also hazard a guess, Drew, that you read it much closer than I did, because I got about 3 pages in and was like, I know what kind of comic this is, and 100% skimmed the rest of it.
Well, I had to pay attention to it. I had to do notes on it.
I know. I didn't. So I was like, yeah, I'm good.
I mean, the farther we go into the story, the worse it gets. And this is,
I have to say, though, I can't really judge the main story based on this comic, though, Drew, because it was only tangentially involved. It really was dealing with an entirely different thing. And was using some of the stuff we've been getting in the main story. So I didn't like it. To be clear, I didn't like the comic, and I have not liked the Gotham War storyline, but it's hard to say to judge Gotham War based on this issue.
Now, I noticed this was also supposed to be concluded in The Joker, The Man Who Stopped Laughing, number 12, which I think is the conclusion to that miniseries that's been running. We didn't review it because I wasn't interested in reviewing it. I wonder if the writer on this is the one that's writing that miniseries.
I would imagine. It definitely seemed, yeah, the Joker part of this definitely seemed like it was dealing with something else.
Yeah. So, but anyways, yeah, you know, I've had no interest in the Joker, the man who stopped laughing, and this didn't help any. I'm still not interested in it. And I'm just glad we're almost done with this Gotham War, because it's really gone off the rails. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Alan Scott, The Green Lantern Number 1, FBI Headquarters. J. Edgar Hoover knows Alan Scott is the Green Lantern. Alan Scott wants to work alone, but Director Hoover wants him to work with the Justice Society of America. Director Hoover has a journal written by Alan Scott, which has all his secrets, including a classified file from his Army days on Project Crimson. California, 1936. Alan Scott has joined the Army Corps of Engineers to help build railroads and levees, but with the rumblings of a new German leader, he is engaged in a top-secret group searching for a weapon called the Crimson Flame. During his off-duty time, Alan Scott spends time with his boyfriend Johnny in secret, as a relationship of their kind in this time period can be considered a crime. The crew of the Dredge finds the Crimson Flame. Alan Scott is able to contain some of it in his invention. New York City, 1941. Alan Scott tells Derby about his visit with Director Hoover. They are interrupted by the radio reporting a bank robbery in progress. Alan puts on his ring and transforms into Green Lantern. Back in 1936, Alan Scott learns that the Crimson Flame is intelligent and attacks the ship, angry that a portion of it has been captured. Back in New York City, Green Lantern arrives on the scene. He is confused because the robbery has already been taken care of by him, according to the police. The police want to know where the suspect is. Witnesses state that Green Lantern took him and headed toward the pier. Back in 1936, Alan Scott frees the Crimson Flame from the ship. In retaliation, the Crimson Flame snatches his boyfriend, Johnny. Back in 1941, Green Lantern tells the police to evacuate the building. The Flash Jay Garrick arrives to help. Green Lantern battles the Crimson Flame. Green Lantern finds the gunman on the roof. It is his boyfriend Johnny from 1936, and he is drowned to death, but has burn marks on his arms. Suddenly, Alan Scott is in the hospital, about to get electroshock treatment.
Drew, I really enjoyed the opening premise to the book, where we have Hoover blackmailing Alan into being an active member of the JSA and not just nominally part of it, and then flashing back, you know, into his time in service. That I liked a lot of that, Drew. And then it got really muddled at the end. Like, I was understanding what the comic was getting at. Like you, Drew, like, I understood that that was supposed to be his dead boyfriend in the present of the story. And I was like, okay, that's a weird jump. I'm assuming we're going to explain that. And then instead they jump to him getting electroshock therapy at what you have to assume is an asylum, presumably for his sexuality. Again, all of that makes sense, Drew, but they just kind of threw it all together all at once right at the end. I was like, whoa, wait, I feel like we could have done one at a time here, guys.
I agree with you. It got a little jumbled at the end. So I'm wondering if the next issue is going to be more straightforward with what's going on.
Yeah, it just was too, again, I understand what their ideas are and what they're trying to do with these different things. So it's not confusing in that sense, but it's putting too much on its plate. Like, it can't do them all at the same time. So I'm very intrigued to read the second issue. I really like the art. I thought the art was perfect for the story. And like I said, the first half of the comic, I was really into it. And I'm not disinterested in each of the other storylines individually. I just don't want them all at once.
So this is our third Green Lantern book now. I'm wondering, we've got multiple Flash books now. We've got multiple Green Lantern books. I'm wondering which ones are going to be sticking around.
I can't see this one sticking around. This one feels like it's made to be a miniseries.
Yeah, it does. And maybe it is a miniseries, but I'm just surprised how many Flash books and how many Green Lantern books we're getting right now.
Yeah, I agree. I do worry about watering down the market a little bit. I think Alan Scott makes for a great idea for a miniseries. So I think this could be pretty good, Drew. Obviously, we'll wait to see more issues to see what, you know, how it develops. But I don't know that it would succeed as well as an ongoing. Not because I dislike the character or anything like that. I just don't know that that character has the same pull as the other two.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Amazon's Attack Number 1, Themyscira. Queen Nubia is informed that 24 hours ago, a woman wearing Wonder Woman's symbol blew up a gas station outside of Alberta. The woman is not an Amazon, but the Amazons are being blamed for the situation. Queen Nubia announces that she has been invited to a secret accord with the American president and plans to attend alone. Queen Nubia visits Io, who is not happy that Nubia is leaving alone. Io wants Nubia to at least take Philippus with her, but the queen refuses. When Queen Nubia arrives at the location, she finds out it is no longer a secret. A girl that Queen Nubia does not know holds up a sign through a window that states Amazons have a right to be here. As the Secret Service escort Queen Nubia to meet the president, their eyes turn yellow and they begin to attack Nubia. Nubia escapes into the kitchen and is attacked by the staff there as well. Suddenly, Faruka jumps out of the shadows to defend her queen with a sword. The Banna Midgol intercepted Themyscira's message to the White House and want to be involved since most of them are not immortal and would be the first to fall in a war with man's world. Queen Nubia still tries to meet with the president, but finds Yara Flor standing over the president's body. She punched him in the face when he and his men attacked her. The Oracle of the Esquisita had a vision of the death of the Amazons. Yara Flor needed to be here. The Amazons and a bunch of men go crashing out a window. Mary Marvel shows up and rescues them all. The police surround them, and Mary uses magic to teleport them to Times Square. While in Times Square, the news is already reporting that a group of Amazons led by Queen Nubia attacked the president and that Mary Marvel has turned into a villain. They are considered terrorists and are now wanted by the United States of America.
I was a little conflicted with this book, Drew, because I really like the team that they've set up. I love that Mary Marvel got included with this group, and getting more Yara Flor is awesome too. And I understand and like the premise of them being framed, you know, as part of this greater Amazon conspiracy to have attacked the U.S., right? Like, that makes sense as the premise for the book. I'm 100% on board with that. I didn't think the book did a great job making me believe it, though. Like, there was never a moment where it felt like they were clearly being tricked into looking like they were attacking. Like, they were always obviously on the defensive, especially Mary Marvel did nothing, Drew. You can convince me of that premise, especially knowing what we're doing with Tom King's Wonder Woman. It makes perfect sense that they'd get portrayed this way, right? But I just didn't think the book did enough with the actual way that they portrayed it. That I was like, I feel like it would have been easy to change the story in some way so that it more obviously looked from the outside perspective like they had actually done something.
That's true, Cletus, but the mass majority of the public is not going to know what's happened in there. They're just going to perceive what the news tells them.
Right, but there was nothing that the news would have... my assumption, Drew, is that the Sovereign is behind the manipulation, right? I'm not sure. It might be a different villain in this book. But again, you're right. The news is the one disseminating this misinformation, but there was nothing that the news caught on camera that I felt would have clearly put that, like, I don't know. It just wasn't enough there to misconstrue. And I think it would have been easy to do, Drew. It would have have one Secret Service guy be possessed on camera and have an Amazon, you know, hit him, knock him out, whatever. Boom. There you go. That's the clip that goes on the news. And I didn't feel like they had that.
Maybe. I just know at this point, perception of the Amazon, you know, the public is against the Amazons already. So most people are just going to, knowing people and knowing the public, they're just going to go after the Amazons for any reason now.
I agree, Drew, and to be clear, I agree. I just felt like the book was too flimsy. Like, the book just sort of relied on you being like, yeah, everybody hates the Amazons right now, so they're going to believe whatever. And I felt like the book just kind of coasted on that without doing, you know, it needed, again, it needed to do very little. And I just don't feel like it did that.
Yeah, I see your point of view.
Again, that being said, though, I don't think that's going to affect the rest of the series. I think that was just, I thought it had a flimsy start to the plot, but a plot that makes complete sense. Like, I'm fully on board with the plot and going forward into issue two. I'm really excited to read the next issue. I felt like issue one could have been stronger jumping into the rest of the story. But again, I don't think that's going to affect the rest of the plot.
I think this Amazon story, Tom King's and this one together, is an interesting story. And it's cool to see these two books kind of tied together.
I agree. And it's just exciting. It's exciting to see the Amazons continuing to be more than just Wonder Woman and being involved in DC stories. It's a really intriguing story. They're involving a character like Miss Marvel. It's an awesome way to keep that character in rotation, right? I like a lot of what they're doing with the Wonder Woman books right now.
All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Action Comics 1058. Outside the Daily Planet, Clark Kent is being beat up by a fake Superman. Clark tricks the fake Superman on using his super hearing, and his ears begin to bleed. Next, Clark uses the kryptonite satellites owned by Supercorp to blast the fake Superman. The fake Superman loses control of his heat vision and uses up all his solar power. The fake Superman falls to the ground. Clark grabs the bracelet from the fake Superman's wrist, which seems to be the source of his power. Nora Stone, the leader of the Blue Earthers, is on Star News claiming she can give humans the powers of Superman. Lois is on the phone trying to get a hold of someone from Supercorp in a lab coat to go on air. Otho and Osel come home from their first day of school at Steelworks Institute along with Kara, John Henry, and Nat. Otho got into a fight because some kids were making fun of her little brother Osel. When Clark comes home all beat and battered himself, Kara takes the twins to the other room to read them a story she found in the Great Library of Kandor. It is a story about the House of Ra and their family's house fable. Elsewhere, Nora Stone returns to some secret temple where she converses with mysterious beings. Nora informs them that she is able to drain the power of a Kryptonian, enough to create her own team of super beings. Nora also believes that she can turn one of the Kryptonians to their cause. Clark reveals to John Henry that Nora Stone siphoned her powers and gave them to her flunky. Clark's powers are recharging, but very slowly. John Henry gives Superman a steel suit of his own in the meantime. We also had two backup stories in this. The first one was called Secret Identity Part 1. Below the city of Metropolis, several weeks ago, Superboy, Supergirl, and the Super Twins have been captured by the Worm Emperor. Kenan Kong saves the day. Kara asks Kenan to join the Super Family officially, but the Super Twins call him a spy and they have proof. They take him to Kenan's Super Spy Lair, otherwise known as his apartment, where he has a whole wall where he's been tracking their movements. Kenan explains that he's been investigating a crime in China that a friend of his thinks that the supers are responsible for. Kenan asks them to reveal their real identities, but Superboy tells him no. Kenan tells his robot, Robin Pod, to scan them. The robot comes back discovering that the dirt on the shoes of the twins comes from a farm owned by the American reporter Clark Kent. Kenan Kong realizes that Superman is Clark Kent and then falls over dead. Our next backup was called Panic at the Parade. Bibbo takes the Super Twins to a parade. Bibbo stops to buy the Super Twins hot dogs when they take off. Not understanding the culture, they attack a float, announcing that the Superman there is fake. Next, they attacked an ambush bug balloon that starts to fall on the crowd. Superman arrives and saves the day. Bibbo asks Superman for kryptonite-laced harnesses for next year.
Could have done without the backups, Drew. I'm not going to lie.
I know exactly what you mean. That last one was just silly.
Yeah. The main story, though, I'm really intrigued in. I'm very curious to find out more about the main villain and who she's really working for. Because it definitely seems to be more going on than just another sort of racist Lex Luthor type character, right? There's something else going on with her.
Yes, and whoever she's conversing with obviously have something to do with magic. But they're using these Blue Earthers prejudiced to further their cause.
Yeah, that's the thing. That was interesting in this, because last issue, it seemed like she was yet another just sort of prejudice against aliens. But this issue, we see that, like you said, Drew, she's kind of using this movement to further her own goals. It doesn't necessarily seem to be her own cause.
So, really interesting. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Detective Comics 1075. Detective Fielding tells his partner, Nash, about how 3 years ago he was involved with busting Scarecrow. He got shot and was infected with fear toxin. Batman saved him. After that, Detective Fielding spent 20 months in a padded cell until he got better. Siobhan arrives at Crime Alley too late. She calls Master Arzen and updates him. Master Arzen states that it is imperative that they reach Batman first so no one else can see what they have done to him. Detective Fielding tells Nash his theory that Batman is Bruce Wayne. They decide to skip Crime Alley and head straight to Wayne Manor. When they arrive at Wayne Manor, Fielding and Nash find Batman in the Wayne family graveyard. Nash notices that Batman doesn't look good. When Fielding decides to call it in, Nash shoots him. Nash calls Siobhan and lets her know Batman's location. When Siobhan arrives, Nash is rewarded with a briefcase full of money. Siobhan puts on her mask and tells Nash to hide out for a week. After a week, Nash will write a letter stating how guilty he is for taking his partner's life. He will reveal the location of the money and then put a bullet to his own head. Master Arzen arrives at the graveyard and tells Siobhan to prepare the transportation. The asthma has taken its toll, and it will be a relief when they hang Batman. Alone with Batman, Master Arzen unmasks him and learns that he is really Bruce Wayne. Master Arzen has made a promise to Bruce Wayne that his legacy would not be forgotten. Batman must die, but Master Arzen believes that Bruce Wayne should be saved. To be continued. We also had a backup story, Take My Hand. Bruce Wayne is brought home to Wayne Manor after the death of his parents. In real life, we see Bruce reach out to Alfred and take his hand. In the spirit world, we see Bruce reach out his hand to Barbados, but he does not give himself over to him. Barbados knows that he will one day.
Drew, for the backup, there wasn't a whole lot of meat on the bone for the story, so I don't really have a whole lot to say there, but the artwork was phenomenal. I loved the artwork of the backup.
What I got out of the backup was, it looked like, you know, Barbados was trying to reach out to Bruce, but he wouldn't accept it. But it feels like this is something that's going to happen with Bruce soon. He's going to reach out to Barbados, and that may be what helps him come back from where he's at this time period. Because Batman's defeated.
Yeah.
What I found interesting in the main story is Master Arzen's connection with Bruce Wayne. We kind of saw it before. He's been trying to make a connection with Bruce Wayne. But here we see that the connection's deeper than we think. It feels like he identifies with Bruce in the fact that maybe Bruce has lost his parents and he lost his father. If you remember that story we had with his father sacrificing himself for his son to live.
Yeah.
I
agree, Drew. That definitely seems to be coming back in play pretty heavily.
So I find that very interesting. And then by saving Bruce Wayne, I wonder if that's what saves Batman too, along with this Barbados thing. At least that's where I feel the story is going. I don't know, but I found it very interesting how this issue ended with Master Arzen wanting to, you know, hang Batman publicly, but wanting to save Bruce Wayne.
And it's one of those things, Drew, where I think there's definitely a reality where you do this ending where I would personally feel really frustrated because, you know, I don't like when heroes get off easy out of circumstances that should be hard. But I trust that that's not going to be the case here, Drew, because they've been laying the groundwork for this. Ron V has been for months setting up the fact that Arzen is still the same broken little boy that Bruce is in some ways, right? So this isn't completely out of the blue where the villain wins and decides for no reason whatsoever to grant mercy to the hero, right? That's not what's happening here. The groundwork for this has been laid for multiple backups, and like you said, Drew, it's just, it makes sense that this is where we're going.
Yeah, it's been really good so far, so I'm looking forward to see what happens next. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, The Flash number 2. Flash is battling a creature. He asks what the creature wants, but it gives no answer. First it destroyed Chad, then one of the apes. Flash creates a windshield using his aura and rams through the creature. The creature reforms itself. Flash enlists the help of Grodd's number 2, Nahoda, but she swats the Flash away with her tech, calling him criminal scum. Flash is teleported into some sort of status bubble. Floating in a bubble around the sun, a voice speaks to Wally. Beings known as the Status freeze Flash and sends him home. They are explorers of an advanced race, and they are studying a class of being known as the Archangels. The Stasis form a ring around the being that Flash was fighting earlier, and then it disappears. The Stasis bid Flash farewell and disappear themselves. Wally returns home and spends the evening with his family. While trying to sleep, an idea comes to Wally. The Flash speeds to Terrific Tech and wakes Michael Holt. The Flash shows Michael that Grodd had been messing with realities in the shape of a hexagon. They calculate where Grodd will strike next and set up an ambush. Mr. Terrific's T-spheres take out all the gorillas except Grodd. Flash fights Grodd and gets a hold of one of his gauntlets. Flash is able to step out of reality and return, getting the drop on Grodd. In the park, Barry Allen sits in front of a statue of the Flash. Iris calls him, wanting to talk through their problems. To be continued.
Drew, I got really strong Grant Morrison Green Lantern vibes out of the first part of this book.
Yeah, I understand that. It was a little confusing, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little. It was easier to follow than Morrison's stuff was with Green Lantern. But, I mean, it was very reminiscent of it, where it was pretty out there. And even the concept of Wally essentially, like, stepping out of reality and then back in was a really cool idea. Like, I like it, but it feels a lot like some of that weird stuff we got with Green Lantern, which I also liked. But it was hard to understand and follow sometimes, and that was definitely the vibe I had in this book too, where it was weird, it was kind of cool. I also didn't fully understand it all the time, and I was like, I mean, I'm enjoying myself. I don't know that I fully get it, but I like it.
Tell you the truth, Clintus, when I read this the first time, I was a little confused, and I was going to do my notes on it, and I didn't even know where to begin. Yeah. I had to take a break from it. When I came back to it and then started getting into it and reread it and did my notes, It made a lot more sense the second time. So it really took some concentration to figure out what was going on in here. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Woman number 2. Not so long ago, Diana was in a tournament on Themyscira to see who would be sent to Man's World. She performed magnificently in all the contests of skill, endurance, and bravery, but wore a mask to hide her identity from her sisters. Diana stands before a seasoned warrior just before the duel. The warrior offers Diana a chance to reveal her identity and accept her mercy. Diana refuses, stating, "If you want my name, win it." Diana battles the warrior, exchanging blows until the warrior finally stabs Diana in the belly, leaving her impaled upon the wall of the arena. The warrior asks Diana again for her name. Diana replies that her name is irrelevant. All her sister needs to know is that now she has two swords and she has none. Diana pushes the two swords up to the warrior's throat and asks for her name. The warrior removes her helmet and states her name is Emily. In the present, Steve Trevor meets with Wonder Woman in the middle of a battlefield. Steve tells Wonder Woman that Sergeant Steele has orders from the president to take her to the ground, however that can be accomplished. When Steve asks her to surrender, she replies, "No, thank you." Steve argues with Diana, stating that there is enough firepower behind him to take over a small country. "I know you're Wonder Woman, but you are not someone who can handle this assault." Wonder Woman responds by stating that neither you nor anyone else have ever earned the right to tell me who I am. The United States Army attacked first with its artillery, second with its tanks, and then with its infantry. Wonder Woman fought for hours until she was surrounded. Wonder Woman shouts, "Men of the field, I admire your courage. I honor your service and your loyalty. I do not wish to harm you, but if you proceed, I will over and over drop a 55-ton Abrams tank on your pathetic little heads. The men retreat and the battle is lost. Sergeant Steele yells a curse. To be continued. We also had a backup story in this. Amazon's attack, the prophecy. Canada, 5 minutes ago. A woman is pumping gas and sees a news report about the Pool Hall massacre. Suddenly, her eyes turn yellow. She walks up to a convenience store, locks the doors from the outside with a rope, and then sets it on fire, yelling asylum. Akahim, city of the Esquisita, now. Anahide, the Oracle, has a vision of a threat to the Amazons. Someone is using the Pool Hall chaos to further their own goals. If they are not stopped, all Amazons will die. All three tribes are in danger. Every Amazon will perish unless Yara Flor can find and unite the three. The Doubting Queen, the Shadow Blade, and the Lightning Hearted. Find them before she does. To be continued in Amazon's Attack Number 1. Now, Cletus, when I did my recap, I separated the backstory from the story that was going on. But Tom King and the artist illustrated it and told the story with them running parallel, and it worked great. I mean, I love this story. It was my favorite comic to read this week.
I agree 100%, Drew. This was phenomenal. This was so good. And Diana was such a badass in both stories. Like, you're getting her defiant courage as a young kid, winning the challenge to be the champion. And then you get her that same defiance, the same courage against the U.S. Army. And, but different, right? Like, she's not fully Wonder Woman as a kid. So, like, that fight doesn't, like, she wins, but it's not pretty, right? Against the U.S. Army, she just dominates, Drew. She just dominates them completely on her own. Unbelievable. Oh, what a good comic. I cannot recommend these first two issues enough. If you like Wonder Woman at all, I'm sure some people won't like it, Drew, but my gosh, it is so good. I have really, really enjoyed these first two issues.
I really enjoyed it too. And it was heartbreaking at the beginning of the issue when we see Wonder Woman and Steve just kind of, Steve's trying to talk her out of it. He knows he's going to fail. You can tell he knows he's going to fail. And he tries to talk her out of it, and he has to go back and do his duty. And she knows he has to do his duty. She's not blaming him for it either. She lets him know that she's not backing down, and she's going to do what she has to. It's a phenomenal comic. And, oh, man, I couldn't describe some of the battle scenes we saw in this. Wonder Woman taking on the planes and the tanks and the missiles, and they are throwing everything at her. It was just freaking awesome. I loved it. Now, the comic actually ended with the flashback forcing the woman to reveal who she is. Did you know who that was, Cletus?
My assumption, I don't know that this is accurate, Drew, but my assumption is that's the mystery woman that we're trying to figure out who attacked at Billings.
Exactly. That's exactly who it was. I actually went back to the first issue to double check on it, and that was the name that Wonder Woman gave when she was first dealing with Sergeant Steele. So, yes, that is her. This is a mysterious woman that started everything. I'm wondering, is she doing this as a revenge thing against Diana, or is it something else?
I don't think she is doing anything to get back at Diana, Drew. That's not my impression. My impression of the first issue was that these men got out of line and she never learned how, like, she didn't win the champion for a reason, right? Like, obviously Wonder Woman beat her, but, like, she wasn't, I don't know. To me, it just felt like she reacted poorly because she doesn't know, like, she just only knows one way of being a warrior. And the Sovereign seized on the opportunity to twist people against the Amazons. That's what it's felt like to me, but, I mean, we'll find out for sure. I could absolutely be way off base on that.
I didn't know maybe it was a revenge thing. You could totally be right, and I could totally be off. But that's what I was wondering. So I was curious. Maybe she's working with the Sovereign, too. I don't know. It's very interesting. And
it's also possible, Drew, that she didn't actually butcher everybody in there either. That she did attack, and then they saw an opportunity, and somebody else went in and cleaned up, so to speak. I don't know, Drew. I think there's a lot more to whatever happened in Billings than what we've found out so far.
Oh, I'm sure of it. And I'm just waiting till we get to the... We know Diana's going to be investigating it, and I'm interested in seeing what she finds out. I'm kind of curious how long this arc's going to go on for.
I'm in no rush.
Oh, I'm in no rush either, but I also want to know answers.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic book talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk Doom Patrol.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
All right, monkeying around, start talking.
Shiny Mr. Bob Alameda.
About your podcast.
We talk about an Emmy-winning comedy series.
We talk about a band who outsold Beatles and the Stones in 1967.
Still sticking to that story, huh? Well, if you know what's good for you, you'll change your tune.
We talk about a groundbreaking multimedia project
that inspired generations of artists and fans.
All right, throw the book at them.
This book is overdue.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
And we're back. Let's talk Doom Patrol Season 4, Episode 11, Portal Patrol. Cliff, Larry, Jane, Laura, and Cyborg are falling through the time stream. Cyborg uses one of his new abilities to encase them in a metal spherical case with windows. Keek leaves Larry's body and exits the sphere. When he returns, he jumps inside of Cyborg's body. Keek has discovered a series of portals within the time stream. Keek sees that there's longevity located on the other side of these three portals. Cyborg gives them all a knuckle from his suit because it has his grid technology in it. He can control it and recall it whenever he needs to. They all have 1 hour. Get in, find the longevity, and then they will be yanked back to the sphere. Cyborg sends out an SOS to any and all frequencies broadcasting to every portal in the time stream, hoping to get an answer. Victor gets an answer from Derek through one of his robots in robotics class. They help him find the correct portal. Laura arrives at the ant farm in 1949 and finds a door that states a mortar's project, Niles Calder. Laura attempts to get the longevity and fails when she confronts a younger version of herself. Larry and Jane end up at Doom Mansion in 1996. Keek takes off and Larry chases after him. Paraguay, 1948. Niles Calder comes into a bar and tells Kipling that he's got the longevity necklace. While Kipling is using the facilities, Robot Man shows up. Robot Man tries to take the necklace, but Kipling unanimates him so he can't move. When Nazis with electrical axes come for Niles, Kipling reanimates Robot Man. Niles and Cliff work together to take out the Nazis. When Cliff's Parkinson's disease kicks in, they help him. When one more Nazi attacks, Cliff throws Niles to save him. Niles hits the bar with his back, and this is how he becomes paralyzed from the waist down. Larry meets with the energy creature that is the father to Keeg. Larry learns that Keeg does not kill him, but together they become a son. Jane meets with Niles and finally admits that she was raped by her father. Jane is able to complete the puzzle, and the underground is destroyed. Kay shows Jane something new. She is all her personalities. She is the kaleidoscope. All the members of the Doom Patrol are yanked back to the sphere. Each have failed at getting the longevity. The Doom Patrol is now a team and will fight to save the world. They are going home. Cletus, I loved how this episode kind of wrapped up everybody's problems. You know, the problems we've been seeing all through the seasons with each of the characters, for the most part, got wrapped up in this episode.
I agree, Drew. This was a great penultimate episode. Like, it's exactly the kind of episode you want leading into the finale, where it's starting to wrap stuff up, but also ramp up towards that final climax and conclusion. Really enjoyed the episode. I would have liked a little bit more from Cliff's in terms... I feel like it just gave him more problems.
I don't think Cliff will ever resolve all his problems.
No, I know, but you know what I mean, Drew? Like, everybody else got a really good sense of closure or like a major breakthrough, and Cliff just breaks the Chief's back. He was a notable exception to the rest of the group. Not to say that his stuff wasn't good, like enjoyable. It was certainly great TV. I can't wait for the finale in terms of like wanting to watch it. I can't wait. In terms of wanting the show to not never end, I don't want to watch it.
I agree with you there, but I'm looking forward to a great ending for the Doom Patrol. I'm hoping they leave out on a high note.
Yeah, I think they will. This whole season has been really strong. I feel like they really, you can tell that they knew that this was the last season, Drew. And they've done such a good job all season long of setting that up. And it just, the whole season has felt very satisfying in concluding what this team has done.
Agreed. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah. So we mentioned earlier in the podcast, the Force of July, who we were both very familiar with, obviously, first appeared in Batman and the Outsiders annual number one in 1984. And so they were, as you would imagine, an antagonistic group, which I found, again, speaking so well to King's writing, where the agent, obviously, from her perspective, views them as American heroes, right? And, you know, veterans, which makes sense from her perspective, but from the comic perspective, they've always been on the antagonistic side.
Cool. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about the original Red Hood story, which I've read in reprints. I don't have the original. It came out in Detective Comics number 168 back in 1951. So I've read reprints of the story, and I always found that story interesting. So that's my shout-out to week. Check it out. And I'll probably use that cover as our classic cover of the week too on our newsletter. So be sure to check that out. I don't know if you've been noticing, Cletus, but for the classic covers, I've been putting the synopsis as I've been getting from DCFandom.com. So I don't know if anybody's been reading through them, but I've been finding the synopsis for these classic covers interesting to read through, especially if you haven't read these stories before. Gives you kind of the overview. Because like this comic... The Red Hood comics, popular enough story, you can find it in reprints, but some other stories, not so much. So, yeah, I've been finding them interesting. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message or text us, or... you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Detective Comics, Batman, Catwoman, The Gotham War, Scorched Earth, Supergirl Special, and of course, our final episode of Doom Patrol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.